Thank you very much, and thank you for coming out, and thank you for being online, our friends, to join us. So I just want to start by defining my terms. So when I talk about disability, I mean physical impairment, sight loss, hearing loss, mental health conditions, intellectual impairments. So that whole broad category. It's the term I use for any lasting mental or physical health condition. And so immediately you can see that impairment is a very complex concept. It's multidimensional, it encompasses lots of different things, and it's scalar. You can have a more or less significant form of impairment. So I have a spinal cord injury, but I have an L2 spinal cord injury, it's the second lumbar vertebrae. If it had been C2, cervical 2, I would have needed a ventilator to breathe, probably. I certainly wouldn't have moved my arms around as I planned to do. So, scalar and multidimensional. However, today I'm going to talk predominantly about Elizabeth Barnes' book, A Minority Body. And Elizabeth Barnes, in a way, restricts herself to just physical impairment. So that might be sight loss, hearing loss, physical impairment. And so that's what I'll restrict myself to. But I want you to know that I think a theory of disability should encompass that broad range. And I think that I could as well, and it would interest me if I started talking about those. And I know that at least one of the audience is very interested in intellectual impairments. And I take it that what I say is also relevant to intellectual impairments, although I will bracket that. So human beings are animals. We've bodies and minds that have evolved over millennia. And in my view, and I'm sure you'll come back at me at this, there is a narrow band of ways of being which comprise evolved functioning for Homo sapiens. So I want to go with a sort of Christopher Bohr's notion of what is an average human being. I don't want to be normative about it, but I think that's what we tend to think of as being Homo sapiens. And I think negative departures from that band, and it's not one thing, it's a band of forms of embodiment, negative departures from that band would be what I call illnesses and impairments. And if occasionally there are positive departures. There are people with extraordinary talents or optimal fitness or amazing abilities that we see in the Olympics or whatever. Those of you are less interesting to me today. I'm not going to talk about them particularly. So I think human beings have these negative departures from what, for the sake of argument, we'll call species typical functioning all the time. And most of these are minor. So in a way, as it's been said, the body is invisible. We don't take account of it until there's something wrong with it. And, you know, I could list for me, I bent this finger back, which is really sore, a few weeks ago, falling in a flower bed because I was drunk. I got up in the night and went to the loo and I bashed my toe on my left-hand side. And I thought I had a pressure sore, but it's not. It's merely me being stupid. I poured boiling water over my hand the other day because I had a cup of tea and I had the shakes. But you've all had these. You probably have them at the moment. Maybe you have a mouth ulcer or you have period pain or whatever else. That is normal human embodiment. It's what we expect. So they are minor departures. None of us are free from these. And of course, they're exaggerated by social and economic disparities. I imagine we have a good diet, we have plenty of fruit and da-da-da, water, everything we need. Therefore, we aren't radically disadvantaged, although some people are. Some people obviously are starving. There are social economic departures. But some people have major departures, considerable predicaments, and so considerable that they become classed as disabled. And I would say that while illness and impairment could be seen as a natural kind, I don't want to go into that, well, you can if you like, are they? But disability isn't. Because, of course, as I said, we all have illnesses and impairment, but we're not all disabled. So I think disability is a social definition. It's a social and cultural artifact, which is different across times and place, depends on your context, your epistemology, your welfare, your politics, everything, as to whether you're disabled. It's not automatic. that you have a second certain level of pre-existent and therefore you must be disabled. Or rather, it's only in context of a particular time and place. So to recap, being a person, being a human being, is to be impaired, to be vulnerable to the impairment. That is us all the time. But to be disabled, I would say, is to be socially classified as having a certain amount, intensity or type of impairment such that you're seen as a disabled person. And of course, mostly, subjectively, people resist being classified as disabled because it's seen as so negative, so pathological, that they don't want to be in it. And of course, in society, there are stereotypes as to what disability is, who is a disabled person, who is seen as disabled. So, for example, an older person may have considerable functional limitation but not be seen as a disabled person because it's normal aging. So notions of normality, as Claire has said in her book, are very much contingent. And this label, and I mentioned politics, socio-political context, this label of you are a disabled person can also become a badge. Like all labels that are imposed, there's a possibility of reversing it and saying, yes, I am a disabled person. That is what I have in common. We will meet. And that might be as neurodivergent people, or it may be as disabled people in a disabled people's group. It could be people with intellectual impairments and so forth, people who identify as mad pride and all the rest of it. So turning a label into a badge, very common. So this is very exciting. Since about 1970, there's been this new social movement of disabled people, or people with disabilities, organizations of people with disabilities. And it's now, I think Jeffrey Weeks talks about identity as like discovering a map to explore a new country. And this political identity is really powerful. Ian Hacking, in his article Making Up People, talks about, you know, social activity which leads to a new possibility, which then has a loop, and people say, yes, I'm that. But I think that there's been a mistake. So I think that everybody is impaired, and what is different is the way disability is ascribed to you or you claim it. What a lot of disability rights people have done is to try and break the link between being a disabled person and being an impaired person and saying that disability is not to do with impairment. Or if it is, impairment is not negatively valorized. You know, it's not a problem. Yeah? So you can see that I'm saying that we're all impaired or vulnerable to impairment. Some people are socially ascribed disabled. A lot of the disability rights movement is saying we are not impaired, or if we are, it's not a problem. So you can see that that's a different strategy. And so in the British social model approach, which is dominant in the British disability movement, there's this distinction made between impairment and disability. And again, as Claire says, very like the distinction between sex and gender. And that is to say that you are, that you have an impairment, we're not going to say much more about that, but you are disabled by society. So it's a lack of accessibility which disables you. It's the negative attitudes which disable you. So that's why in Britain we say disabled people, because you are disabled by society. And it's very strong in Britain. Society has grown up on the basis. It's like when I came to Cambridge in 1984 to a college, and I was in the first year of a mixed college. Previously, it had only been men. And so the fellows, who are largely sexist and antiquated, you know, decide, well, what are we going to do with all these women? And one of them said, I think we should dig a big hole in the grounds and change it all there. You know, so old, crusty, buffer, misogynistic attitudes. And as it was, they acknowledged women and they put full-length mirrors in the bathroom. So that was their tribute to women, really. So there you are, you can have that. And that's both of those things are entirely true. So what I've tried to say in my books, and I wrote a book called Disability Rights and Wrongs, is that it is true that discrimination and prejudice are a major part of the difficulties faced by disabled people. But I also want to say that impairment can itself be a difficulty. So I'm arguing against the social model of disability. I'm arguing against the minority group model, which is powerful in America. And so far, I think I've got away with it. But then along has come this book by Elizabeth Barnes, and in a way in 2016, and it's the best of the, there's increasingly philosophy of disability, and I think it's the best of the philosophical defences of the account of disability as a mere difference. So if I'm right, I have to knock this down. I'm not sure I've quite done it today, but that's what I'm trying to do today. And if you are genuinely interested in the philosophy of disability, I strongly advise you to read this book. It's a very good book. She's a good philosopher, I think. But I think she makes a number of errors, and I will try and identify those. She does two things in this book. First of all, she redefines disability, and she doesn't make this impairment-disability distinction. But disability becomes those forms of life for which the disability rights movement should be trying to secure justice. So what is disability? Disability is what the disability rights movement should say it is. It's not what they actually say it is. She's obviously open to the fact that disability rights groups may be, you know, discriminatory in any way that you choose. But following the logic of the disability rights movement, disability is that which the disability rights movement should be trying to secure justice. So she's got a different view of the category. And secondly, she describes that category, disability, as what she calls mere difference, removing the association, the necessary association, with negative forms of embodiment. So I'm going to try and address both those claims in the time that I have. So let me think about that first claim, that disability is what the disability rights movement should say it is. And what she says, and remember, she's only talking about sight, hearing, sight, and physical impairments. She says it makes up too many different phenomena to be a useful category if you base it in this bodily departure. There's too much going on. Remember, I said it was multidimensional and scalar. She wants to go further than that. She says because there's no, because it's not a natural kind, she argues, then she thinks that if you talk about limitation of functioning, departures from species typical functioning, pain, all of these, she says, are incoherent. So they don't construct a category that's discrete, that's clear. And she's trying to avoid normative judgment because she says in a way that's to introduce a circularity. Yeah, what is impairment? Impairment, you know, is defined as what part. Yeah, so she's worried about those, and she would disagree with me. I'm absolutely sure. And so she shows that all of these attempts to make a describe a category are flawed, because she says, for example, you know, if you think you can explain what disability is, what about the person who's very petite? What about a person who's not got a disability but is quite small and therefore can't reach things? You can't reach things, Tom, because you're restricted growth. She or he can't reach things because they're small. But they're not disabled, are they? It's an incoherent category. Or what, you know, lots of people at the margin of the category who might have obesity or other limitations. And she says, well, you can't distinguish. Either your definition is all-encompassing and it includes too many people, or it starts saying, oh, you're not really disabled. So that's why she concludes, quote, disability is all and only those things the disability rights movement ought to consider as things they're promoting justice for, what I've just described. It's ingenious. It's very unusual. I don't think it's common in philosophy to say that. It's not normative. It's not circular. And you know, obviously, you're very interested in different areas of history, I'm sure. So on these terms, can we say that Richard III or whoever was disabled? Because there was no disability rights movement at the time. And she says, well, you know, she's sort of Foucauldian about this. She says disability is different at different times. But if Richard III was here today, we would say that his impairment was the sort of impairment that the disability rights movement ought to be supporting, including fighting for justice for. Therefore, we can say that he's disabled. So it's quite ingenious. It has lots of strengths. So how would I respond to that first claim? Well, I think we need to be very clear-eyed about the disability rights movement for a start, because the disability rights movement does a lot of heavy lifting in our argument. So, for example, worldwide, less than 10% of disabled people are in organisations of disabled people. In Britain, far fewer people would be members. There was a survey which found, I think, that 3% of disabled people understood the social model, for example, which is a central tenet of British disability rights. There was a survey from the Department of Work and Pensions called Disabled for Life, which found that only 50% of people who had rights under the Disability Discrimination Act identify as disabled. So when it's now not, it's been superseded by the Equality Human Rights Commission, but when there was a Disability Rights Commission, they couldn't go out and say, we support disabled people. Because a lot of people said, well, that's not me. They had to say, we support people who have rights under the Disability Discrimination Act. And that brought in twice as many people. And I don't necessarily think that the movement always speaks for its members as it should do. And again, think about that statistic only 3% of people have heard of the social model. Many disabled people do consider that health issues are a major part of being disabled. There was a survey in 2009, I think, for the British Social Attitude Survey. They went out and asked people what they thought were the big issues for disabled people. And it said basically health issues or prejudice and discrimination. And overall, the majority agreed with me. They thought it was both health issues and disability and discrimination. But actually, the disability rights, no, sorry, that's not true. Actually, people who identify as disabled were more likely, not less likely, more likely to think that bodily limitations was more of a problem. So in fact, the non-disabled people say, oh, it must be barriers. And the disabled people say, well, a lot of it is actually not being able to do stuff. So I think she almost, I know she says what the disability rights movement ought to espouse, but certainly, you know, you end up with this sort of, I don't know what you would call it, but a complex where actually there never has been, she's sort of almost reified or idealised the disability rights movement. And I'm not sure it'll do the work that she does with it. Remembering that, so I'm sceptical. I think it's ingenious, but I don't think it works, this disability rights movement approach. I agree with Elizabeth Barnes. Disability, as I said to you right at the start, is very heterogeneous, visible and invisible, congenital and acquired. All the many forms of impairment, we could talk about just achondroplasia, short stature, spinal cord injury, cerebral palsy, multiple sclerosis. I've got a friend who's been in contact with me, he's got cystic fibrosis, who has to have, and you said in your book, an hour or so of physiotherapy every day, and he's just broken something from coughing and things like that, you know, and he's going to die. He's going to die of his condition. He knows that and we know that. I'm not going to die of achondroplasia. It's very, very unlikely. So it is very heterogeneous. But I think there will always be debate about boundary cases. You know, any category, there's debate about boundary cases. So the heterogeneity of a category shouldn't, for me, mean it isn't a reasonable category. So, for example, you know, what if somebody has a gene associated with a condition, but they don't currently have it, but they will possibly or probably go on to have it? Are they disabled? Well, no, because they have no symptoms. But perhaps because as soon as you know that they are likely to have it, you discriminate against them. And maybe they, you know, if you talk to people who've got Huntington's disease, triplet repeat, you know, will they have children? What is their plan in life? Will they have a life? You know, all of those questions. They don't have any symptoms, but they know that they'll probably get the disease, and therefore, even though they look, as it were, normal, they're harboring this notion which leads them to have a different life plan and possibly leads to discrimination. And there's lots of evidence of discrimination against people with different genes. But it is heterogeneous. But I don't think that the heterogeneity means that the concept is not helpful. So Wittgenstein talks about, as you well know, about family relationships in Philosophical Investigation. So in paragraph 66, he writes about, quote, a complicated network of similarities overlapping and crisscrossing, sometimes overall similarities. And he continues, I can think of no better expression to characterize these similarities than family relationships. for the various resemblances between members of a family. Build, features, colours of eyes, gait, temperament, etc. overlap and crisscross in the same way. And so it seems to me that disability is like that. You know, we can talk about family relationship between different sorts of disability. And we can go further. We can look at Peter Rinch and the idea of a social science. And he talks about human behaviour following rules. In this case, the rule of understanding what we mean by disability. Quote, I want to say that the test of whether a man's actions are the application of a rule is not whether he or she can formulate it, but whether it makes sense to distinguish between a right and a wrong way of doing things in connection with what he or she does. And I think, you know, you notice that when I introduced the concept of petite, because immediately I would think that most of you thought, oh, clever, but that's not right. We wouldn't think of a petite man or woman as disabled. There's something extra that's needed there. So you know the rules, and we probably would have a disagreement as to where, and lawyers have disagreements as to who's covered by the Equality Act and by the Americans with Disability Act and so forth. But we do know the rules. And what Rinch says is that we have to have the possibility about being mistaken about applications of the rule. And we can say that. We can say, oh, you say this, but we'll disagree. And I'm sure we'll have a debate with it afterwards. But somebody will say, oh, but you haven't applied the rule correctly. So we know there is a rule. And we know it's sometimes wrongly used. And we say often, and we say mostly, because there is broad consensus. We probably would disagree about certain things. And here it's really important to introduce a distinction which Elizabeth Barnes doesn't talk about, which is between subjective and objective notions of disability. So I think that how do we do it objectively? We do it in a census. We ask everybody the same question. And we construct our notion of disability based on that. And how would we do it subjectively? We'd say, put your hands up if you're disabled. And I don't know, would the spectacle wearers have a moment of doubt? Should I? Does he mean us? Should I put my hand up? Or maybe somebody who's gone to 23andMe and they know that they've got certain genetic changes. Well, sort of, not quite. Or I broke my arm the other week. Am I temporarily disabled? You know. So it's subjective. No, I don't want to be identified as disabled. I'm able-bodied. I just have a momentary issue. So subjective and objective, I think, are different. And as I say, disability is a social category. I remember when 2011, we had the World Report on Disability, and it got all the headlines. And it got all the headlines because we said that there are 15% of the world's population were disabled, which is 1 billion people, which is great on a tote bag or in a slogan or whatever. And the disability movement loved us because there was like half as many more disabled people than they thought. Because it had always been, we found the back of an envelope was 10%. No, 15%. And I said, look, I have to defend this in public. Please explain to me how you came up with 15%. And a statistician, well, he's not a statistician, he's a psychiatrist, took me aside and said, well, what we did, we had a World Health Survey, we had over 10,000 people in it, and we had 8 domains, sometimes 16 domains, and they had a score in each domain, and then we did something called RASH analysis and item response theory, and we put it all on one continuum, and then we had to decide where to cut off. And in order to get the 15%, we took people who everybody would agree with had disability, found out what they scored, and they scored about 40, and so we said to cut off there, how much does that make? About 1 billion, 15%. And we thought that'll do. And so there were people in that survey who were not caught by this category, but were undoubtedly disabled. And I suspect there are a few people who were caught who would never think of themselves as disabled. But it's an artifact. It's how you measure it. And I don't have a problem with that. But it's still something real. And I remember when we did the 2011 study, countries, low-income countries said, are you telling us that we have to give the disability pension to 15% of the population? Because we can't afford it. And we all said no. You have to have equal rights for them. You have to prohibit discrimination for them. You have to have accessibility for them. But they're not dependent. They don't need a pension. A much smaller group might not be able to work. They need a pension, 110 to 190 million, I think we said it was. They need the pension, but not the 15%, not the billion. So that's useful. And of course, the subjective objective thing, I'm not saying that 15% of the population would consider themselves disabled. I'm saying objectively for the purpose of that survey, and we've talked about older people, we talked about, well, I did research with restricted growth people, and they didn't consider themselves disabled until their impairments were really serious. They say, oh no, I'm different, I'm not disabled. Now in the survey, they'd have probably seen themselves disabled. So that's the first claim, and we can discuss whether I've actually successfully demolished it, but I don't think I think there are good reasons to think that there are physical similarities, family resemblance and so forth, and I think that it is a social process as to who is ascribed disability and not. So her second claim in this book is in a way much more important, because she says disability is mere difference. And that's really important because, of course, I've been arguing for years that impairment is a problem. And she's basically saying that impairment is not necessarily a problem. It may be for some people, but simpliciter, it is not a problem. It's a mere difference. It's a minority body. She knows that people with this condition can't do everything. People with hearing loss can't enjoy music in the same way. Somebody with sight loss can't necessarily enjoy nature in the same way, or visual art. I would love to dance tango. I would love to play competitive sport with my peers. I can't do any of those things. Not particularly serious, but it's a problem with impairment. And what she says is that the mere difference view need not deny that disabled people miss out on some intrinsically good abilities or experiences. It's just they have access to other, different, good things. So she says it's neutral with respect to well-being. The social model, it's a bit more complex than the social model approach. Because the social model approach is saying, yes, you have an impairment, but the problem is disability on top of your impairment, the barriers, the problems, and so forth. And the social model has gone on to talk about those disabling barriers, but really not talk very much about the role of impairment. And that's where I criticise it. I think it should talk more about the role of impairment and the actual limiting role of impairment. But she says, look, overall, it's a mere difference. So she's stronger. She's a more complex account. I should have said right at the start, I'm a sociologist, not a philosopher. You've probably noticed by now. So I do think it's important empirically what happens to disabled people. We can look at the Office of National Statistics, 2020, working age disabled people, so 16 to 65 or whatever, disabled people's average well-being ratings in the UK are poorer than non-disabled people for happiness. Life satisfaction measures were also poorer. Average anxiety levels are much higher for disabled people, 4.47 out of 10 compared with 2.91 out of 10. Disabled people were four times as likely to be lonely. Half of working age disabled people were employed on average. It's 4/5 of non-disabled people. Only 1/5 of autistic people were employed. So there are lots, and we can go on, there's lots of evidence. I've talked to you about my friend with cystic fibrosis, we could go on. And of course, a social model theorist would say that yes, people do have a hard time, but that's because of barriers. You eliminate the barriers, then they'll lead good, full lives. That's all about ableism or discrimination. Barnes is saying more than that, more than a social model theorist would. She is happy to concede that there are bad things about impairment. She just thinks that impairment overall is a mere difference, not a bad thing. So there are other aspects of impairment which are good. And that's interesting. She talks about more insight, more appreciation of other faculties, more sense of proportion, happiness with your body. It's very interesting talking to Claire. if I take off my clothes, you know that I have an impaired body. You're not surprised by what you see. But conventional people have, you know, they have all the externalities of, you know, acceptable beauty or normality. And of course, we all take off our clothes. We all look saggy and baggy and grey, and or not grey, but certainly not as beautiful as we look on the outside. We are normal. We are average. That is what it is to be human. So there are certainly good things about being disabled. We came a long way through the notorious corridors in Newnham. And previous to being in a wheelchair, there's no way I'd be able to walk that far. Even without spinal cord injury, I could have walked for days. Everybody else was getting tired and frustrated, but I was going, now bring it on. And similarly in an art gallery, you know, I can go around an entire art gallery. I don't have to sit down. I was sitting there, it's brilliant. Everybody gets out of my way. I can see all the art. Fantastic. Now, those are all new things to me. I didn't always have a wheelchair. Had a wheelchair since 2008. So becoming more disabled did give me some positive things. But overall, it's a terrible thing. You know, overall, I don't want to be in a wheelchair. I want to dance tango. I want to go for walks. I want to ride my bicycle like I used to. All of these things. So I am willing to accept that there are some benefits. I'm interested in whether you can achieve those benefits in other ways. And there was nothing to stop me using a wheelchair before. I just didn't tend to. If I want greater insight, don't I think more? If I want, you know, sociality, you know, there are plenty of groups that I can join and feel part of a bigger thing than myself. So I don't think that any of the additional benefits that Barnes records as being attributable to disability are necessarily, you could get them in other ways, in other words. So Barnes contrasts her mere difference view with a conventional account, which she calls the bad difference view. The bad difference view does say that instrumentally having an impairment may lead to good things, but because it enables you, for example, to join a community, but the impairment itself is not a good thing. So Barnes says, if this is a fictional person, if she could, who is impaired, if she could keep her friends, her interests, and her community, but lose her disability, most people would think she would be better off. That's me. Yeah, I would agree with that bad difference view. For her, it's not about instrumentality. It's about the view of disability as mere difference itself. And again, we can maintain that disability is mere difference without maintaining that everything about disability is perfectly fine and shouldn't be ameliorated. So what she wants to say, on balance, impairment is not bad, even if some aspects of it might be difficult. And she distinguishes between local bads. So she, for example, says, well, you might be a parent who's visually impaired and you can't see your baby's face. That's clearly a bad, but it's a local bad. It doesn't mean that everything is bad. And yes, as I've said, there are some benefits to being having an impairment. And she's not going with what she calls an X-Men view. It's not like compensatory abilities, because if you've seen a film, X-Men, lots of those people, you know, like, is it Magneto, is it a wheelchair? Yeah, they are impaired, but then they can, I don't know, wheel electricity or do things, storms, all the rest of it. Very exciting. So she's not saying that. She does say that, you know, being a disability impairment could be a narrative resource, an epistemic resource. But my view is that many of those benefits could be held without having to have an impairment. So I think a lot of her arguments are quite questionable. So it's true that the mere difference position that she takes is not the common position. And it's not your intuition. And she says, well, intuition's not always right, which we obviously know. She said, Kant and Hume might be racist or sexist. So that, you know, although we agree them with lots of other things, their intuitions were possibly false. Therefore, your intuitions may be possibly false. Yes, that's true. It might be like that, but it might not. You know, a lot of Kant and Hume's intuitions were correct. Their arguments were correct. We agree them now. So we don't have to accept all of them. But I suppose what she's trying to say is that this intuition could be prejudice. It couldn't be right. I think that one of the major, for me, one of the major reasons that I think impairment is problematic is pain. And pain is the commonest symptom reported by disabled people, by anybody, a commonest health symptom. And obviously a lot of impairments, a lot of illnesses involve pain, like my friend with cerebral palsy, or cerebral palsy, yes, cystic fibrosis, yes, spinal cord injury, yes, endometriosis, yes, arthritis, yes, a lot of conditions, and I haven't named them all, which involve pain. Pain is very complicated. I know that. Barnes adduces that. She says, look, men and women feel pain differently. People in different ethnic groups feel, or at least they report pain differently. That is all true. Some people report a lot of pain who don't seem to have any impairment at all. Other people seem to manage pretty well with what, and other people. So there is not a straightforward relationship between an objective account of pain and a subjective account of pain. Yes, we know all that. But when she goes, and always she stops there. She says, look, I can show you that pain is very complicated. Yep, got that. Therefore, it's always the implication, therefore it doesn't matter. And I would differ with her. I would say, yes, it is very complicated, but it matters a lot. And it is, she says, the assumption that physical pain is neatly and directly correlated with reduction in well-being is a crude oversimplification. I'd agree with her. I do think pain is complex, but I think it's very significant to a lot of people. We can't just dismiss it. And it certainly wouldn't be people's subjective experience that you can dismiss it. Now, Barnes, of course, says we should listen a lot to the perspectives of people with disabilities. Here, and quite often in her book, she draws parallel with gay people, women, other genders, other minorities, saying that impairment is not a problem. And it is very common to find that activists say impairment is not a problem. But I think, and I do agree with her that we should listen to disabled people, but I think the fact that they say impairment is not a problem doesn't mean that it's not a problem. For a start, I think the association with other sexualities, other ethnicities with women is a false analogy. I think that, yes, the disability rights movement looks a lot like other women's movements, that many of which are recorded in these walls, with other sexualities, with other genders, with other ethnicities, with other subaltern movements. It does look, you know, all the same tactics. But because it looks like that, and because people say it's like that, doesn't mean it is like that. I think that in the case of other forms of life, there are no differences which explain or subordination or explain why people would feel bad about having that condition. I mean, for example, and I know this is a utilitarian suggestion, but forgive me for that. Let's say a person is pregnant, and you say, okay, boy or girl, and they go, I don't mind. And you go, right, with a flash of my wand, you're gonna have the other sex baby. Now, I don't think, certainly for your first baby, you certainly wouldn't, that's not harm to the child. But if you say, look, disability, you know, it's not about impairment, it doesn't really matter what impairment you have, you know, so I'm just gonna give this baby, this fetus, an impairment. You would mind considerably. That is your intuition. That's the example John Harris uses, and he's a consequentialist of first order. But I do agree with him on this. I don't agree with him on everything else. I don't think it's trivial. And if you speak to any disabled people and you say, okay, like me, for example, I've got spinal cord injury. I've not got good sensation in my legs. I can't walk. And if you said, okay, we'll give you a more serious spinal cord injury, let's say it's up here, or you know, right up, you can't breathe very well, you can't move your arms. I say, no, thank you. I'll stick to what I've got. And I think everybody with an impairment says they don't want it any worse. For example, I've got a friend and she has no arms, so she drives with her feet and she's brought up two children with her feet and she's, yeah, eats with her feet, and she's done everything, fantastic. Really well-developed feet. But what happens when she gets arthritis because she used her joints in ways that they shouldn't be used? What, you know, she's suddenly going to be, all of her ways of managing fail, I postulate. Similarly, somebody with cerebral palsy and they use their body in unusual ways, it'll wear out faster. The joints will wear out. They'll have all sorts of aging with cerebral palsy is very difficult. And so on and so forth. So I think that it is a false analogy, that there's something about having an impairment which is problematic and which people see as problematic. And that's why it's different from being a woman. Or, yeah, I know I mentioned menstrual pain earlier. I know that not everything is easy at all. I'm not saying it is. But overall, it seems to me that it's in a different category, genders, sexualities, ethnicities, to disability. And I think we place it there. And it's very interesting because a friend of mine, and I'm, just give you two examples. So I have, when I've blanked somebody on Twitter because they have big discussions and tell me I'm wrong about the social model. Social model is right, social model is everything. And yet I know that that person has physical issues and I sympathize with them, but and they talk about them quite a lot. And I'm just thinking, how can you maintain the social model is everything while still maintaining that you wish you didn't have all of these health issues and impairment issues consequential on your impairment? Surely they're not commensurate. And similarly, a dear, dear friend of mine, we were talking in private and we were moaning about pain. Every day I moan about pain. And aches and pains, and you know, he was moaning about, and he had a disability. And then he went out in public to an audience like this, and he said, the social model is everything, impairment is nothing, we're disabled by society, not by our bodies. And then afterwards they all went, and I said, mate, just in private, you told me that the real body was the real problem at the moment. He said, yeah, but I'm not going to tell them that. And I think that's the difference between being an activist and being an academic, being an intellectual. We're trying to get to the truth. Whether we ever get there is another matter. But we can't possibly say one thing in public and another thing in private. I think that there's, I've overshot and I'll wind up. I think disability is an example of identity politics. And I follow Nancy Fraser and I in this, and I think that she's right, that identity politics tends to be inward-looking, tends to be sectarian, and tends to be about bolstering group identity. And she says instead we should talk about what she calls parity of recognition. So, you know, you and me as two people, we should be equal. It's not to say my group should silence your group or be more powerful than your group. What we're fighting for is to be, Tom and Claire and Marcus and all the rest of it, treated as ordinary human beings. And that is what disabled people have always fought for. Not that the disability group has a right to be heard. So, as I said at the start, I think that the disability rights movement has gone the wrong way in terms of impairment. I think Barnes epitomises that. She's very good at what she does, but I think sometimes she's logic chopping and other times, you know, I just don't feel that it's a robust argument. I think everybody is at risk of impairment, and we should be building a world in which impairment doesn't matter. So, for example, you know, we came in, Claire and I, to this college, and I wanted the loo. And the first loo I went into, and it said it was for staff only, so immediately we've got a social category there, I couldn't get my wheelchair in, and we came out and I said to the porter or person helping, I said, look, where am I? The accessible loo is down there. So I went to accessible loo and it was fine. There was a handbar, it was absolutely fine. It was good, it was huge. That's what we want. We want that to be available. It's like at Jesus College. Yeah, there's a ramp, but there's what looked like a locked door. And then I realized my friend was leaning on the button. You press the button and apparently locked door opens and down the ramp you go. And it was all wonderful. That's what we want. It's like the silly people in my old college. We want everywhere to be accessible. Everywhere to have accessible toilets. Everywhere to have ramps. Sign language when you need it. Subtitling when you need it and all the rest of it. So I think we need to say that everybody is at risk of impairment and that therefore we want impairment not to matter. I think that disabled people are of equal moral worth to everybody else. And I think there's a paradox here, and I'll just leave you with this perhaps. I think impairment is bad. I think it is limiting. I think that's the definition I want to go with. But life with impairment is not bad. And I think that's the central paradox. And you're better philosophers than I am, so I hope you can help me with this. But it does sound like a paradox. If life with impairment is bad, is good, how can impairment be bad? But I think we need an account which allows us to prevent impairment, which allows us to treat impairment, which allows us to say we want to avoid impairment. But if you have an impairment, it doesn't mean you're going to have a bad life. And in fact, everybody is of equal moral worth, whether you have an impairment or not. And a lot of the work I do is saying, look, disabled people have contributed to society in all sorts of ways, to history. They're really valuable, from Beethoven to many, many other people. So life with impairment is good, but impairment is bad. And we can do all sorts of ways. We can reduce that in all sorts of ways. But that's the way we should go, not to say that it's a mere difference. So I'll stop there. Sorry I've overshot. Thank you for listening.